Welcome to Florida Forum. I'm Ann Bocock. My first guest today has turned her family's immigrant story into a fascinating book. It spans five generations, really a journey from the Enlightenment to the Holocaust to America, and it's not your typical immigrant story. Author Elisa New will join me shortly. Speaking of reading, here's a concept. What if we all read the same book at the same time? I'm going to let Darlene Kostrup give us the pertinent information. She is the executive director of the Palm Beach Literacy Coalition. Jim Snyder will be here a little later in the show. He's the author of five books on local history. There is much rich history to celebrate in Jupiter, including the opening of one of the oldest houses in the county. And the Norton Museum of Art has an incredible season, from history to fashion to photography to priceless treasures. Alexia Davis will give us a sneak peek at what's ahead, and she's going to fill us in on a unique monthly event, Art After Dark. This is Florida Forum. Elisa New is a literary scholar and a professor of English at Harvard University. She has left the cold Northeast for what I guess she thought was going to be warm and sunny Florida, but she's here now doing readings and signings of her new book, Jacob's Cane. Welcome, Elisa.
So happy to be here.
Even if it is a little chilly.
Quite chilly.
Jacob's Cane is a story, a saga that spans five generations of your family. And it was interesting for me. It's not the typical poor Russian or Polish immigrant coming to America story. Your ancestors didn't really need to make it in the New World. They had prosperous lives in Europe.
That's true. I think one of the most interesting things I discovered as I was researching my book were those communities all over Europe where Jews were at the forefront of progress. Places where Jews invented things, absorbed new technologies from Germany and elsewhere, and were turning modernity to economic good use. And so I tell a story about people who come to America with a rich archive of experience behind them.
Give us an idea of who these people were.
Well, my book especially concerns two men who began as friends and then became bitter enemies. One was my great-grandfather, Jacob Levy, who arrived in Baltimore in 1884 with considerable experience, I believe, in leather. And he was a man who became a shrinker. Shrinking is an industry we don't know that much about these days, but it's still done. If your clothes aren't shrunk before you put them on, well, they'll shrink after. He, in Baltimore, having arrived from the Baltic states, met a man named Bernard Baron, who had experience and was rising with the help of another crucial industry in the 19th century, the tobacco industry. And my book tells the story of these two men who met, who had common interests in manufacturing, had common political interests, and who eventually, however, found themselves at odds.
There is a lot to tell. There are a lot of stories in this book. I want to fast forward for a minute to your childhood. And there is a lovely picture in the beginning of the book of your three great aunts. Is this where you started to hear the stories?
When I was a little girl, I used to hear stories on the one hand of my great-grandfather, an intellectual, an ardent socialist, and as I said, a shrinker in Baltimore, from my aunts. And I would also hear stories of my great, the man they called my great Uncle Baron, who manufactured cigarettes and went to London, where he eventually built an enormous factory, became really fabulously wealthy, was his children were knighted, et cetera. There's sort of a, there was a masterpiece story, a kind of Jewish tale. I'm sorry, a masterpiece theater sort of Jewish tale that my aunts would tell, my my three great aunts. The picture you refer to represents them in what, for me, was their prime in their 80s, when they functioned really as sort of my three fairy godmothers.
That's what it reminded me of, seeing that they're lovely. That was a, it was a lovely picture.
Well, I had to fight with the publisher to get their picture in.
I'm glad you won that one. Speaking of pictures, on the very cover of the book is this beautiful cane, where this story evolves. When did you first see the cane?
I first saw the cane around 10 years ago in a Baltimore ranch house, the house of my cousin Buddy. It's a long story. I won't tell it now. It's in the book. But the cane was one that I had seen represented in heirloom family photographs. I'd seen them in this cane in photographs really all over the world, in London, in Baltimore, in Israel. And just having lunch with my cousin Buddy, he happened to mention that he had this cane. And I was astounded. I said, you have that cane? He said, yes, I do. Come see it sometime. 3 weeks later, bringing my 12-year-old daughter with me, I went to Baltimore, and Buddy put this beautiful walking stick in my hands. It was engraved. It had writing, scrolls of initials and other writing, much of it in German, all over it. And it was an object that in some way solicited or begged for narration. And so I followed it.
This was your treasure map.
This was my treasure map, my Rosetta Stone, my pointer. A cane is an extraordinary metaphor for a journey of this kind, since it's what one takes to assist one in a journey.
And what a journey you took. There's so much information. You did incredible research. But where did you go to find all of this information?
I went, the cane eventually took me to the Baltic states, where my great-grandfather and Bernard Baron had been born. So I went to Lithuania and Latvia, and really there learned about a way of Jewish life that one doesn't hear about in the usual immigrant stories. I went all over the Middle Atlantic states and into North Carolina to study tobacco, even spending a wonderful day in the tobacco fields owned by Philip Morris, and came to understand, of course, we think smoking is terrible, and indeed it is, but came to understand the incredible allure of this product that smells so good, that looks so beautiful. I went multiple times to the city of Baltimore, working both in the actual archives of the various libraries there, but also in the mysterious archive of the city, walking the streets.
I'll say Baltimore plays a big part.
Baltimore, it turns out, I certainly didn't know this, was the second most important immigrant port in America through the 19th century. It had been even more important, in fact, much more important than New York, for hundreds of years before, since the major trade good going in and out of Baltimore was that crucial American commodity, tobacco. So I learned all about Baltimore. It turns out, of course, just to finish with my travels, that materials that helped me understand this book were in places I never would have imagined. in Boston, in Harvard's own Baker Library, one of the great libraries of the world that collects, for instance, the Dunn's credit reports from the entire 19th century. Dunn's credit reports tell you more about American history than you would believe. The book also took me to Israel, where in the epilogue I solve one final mystery. In fact, solving that mystery after the book had already been published, I ended up rewriting the epilogue.
There is a photograph towards the end of the book of the Levy family. Jacob is holding this cane. And like you said, you saw pictures your whole childhood of the cane.
This is the photograph.
That is the photograph. I think I counted 17 people in this picture. All ages, children, adults, older people. How many survived the Nazis?
Only one, except for Jacob, who was by that time had been in America for many years. This picture was taken in 1928, and just as you say, represents old people, babies. All of them were killed by the Nazis in places and in ways I was astounded to find out a great deal about, except one. One survived, and I won't tell you that story because it's one of the mysteries.
You solved. Know, I think there's a lovely addition for me reading it, the relationship between you and your daughter that I find through this book, who was young when you started, a young teen, I think, when you started to do the traveling.
Yes. In part because when I first saw the cane, my 12-year-old daughter was with me, and the idea to follow this cane really did happen with her in my presence. I took her with me on my very first trip to the Baltic states, to Lithuania and Latvia. We went there a few weeks before her bat mitzvah. And as she grew, this book, by the way, took me almost a decade to complete. As she grew, she became more and more a part of the book. By the last trip I took to the Baltics, she was in college. She had begun to study Russian, and her Russian was at that point strong enough that she could act as my translator. Acting as my translator, she then became really part of the narrative in a way that I wouldn't have dreamed when she was 12 years old. And the book is, it is a book about our relationship, about a mother-daughter relationship, and also a book about other parents and their children. Parents who keep their children, parents who lose their children, about the estrangement, inexplicable estrangements that can happen in families, as well as a sort of continuity that holds a family together.
What was the most surprising thing that you discovered during this journey?
Oh, that's a hard question.
Because I'm assuming the book did not end up the same book that perhaps you had in your mind when you first started.
Certainly not. I didn't realize certainly how much a part of the book I was and my daughter was, and how personal this story would become was something that surprised me. But to put this same point a slightly different way, what I didn't realize is how every family story really is a lens on history. And I guess one could say all history is a family story. I didn't understand that any person's profession, the profession of shrinking or of tobacco manufacture, the professions that are listed in 19th century phone books next to everyone's name, it will say apron maker next to someone's name or tobacco manufacturer. I didn't realize that every American family was part of such world historical movements as the rise of the as industrialization, or as the rise of progressive democracy, or as the experiences of any Jewish family in Europe, one finds a microcosm of what of the terrible things that happened in the 20th century.
It is a fascinating book. It was a journey for me, and
I'm so glad.
And I really did appreciate it. I want to thank you for that. I know your book will appeal to this audience, and Lisa New is going to make several appearances locally. I'd like to tell you what they are. On the 10th, 4 o'clock, she'll be at the Jewish Museum of Florida in Miami Beach. On the 11th, the Russell JCC in North Miami Beach. Books and Books in Coral Gables on the 12th. And the JCC in Boca Raton on the 13th, and also at Broken Sound on the 15th. I think I got them all in.
I think you did. Thank you so much.
By the way, Lisa New is married to Larry Summers, who is economic advisor to President Obama. Any economic wisdom you would care to impart to us today?
I think the book is more reliable as an economic history for my being married to Larry.
Good, well said. The book is Jacob's Cain. Lisa New has been my guest. It has been a pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so here's the challenge. Let's get every adult in Palm Beach County to read the same book at the same time. It is the Read Together Palm Beach County 2010 campaign. And I'm going to welcome Darlene Kostrup, who is Executive Director of the Palm Beach Literacy Coalition. Happy New Year.
And thank you so much for having us on this very important weekend.
I know it. Now, look at this. This is, how many, we've done this, what, five times?
This will be our fifth time.
This is the fifth time. Okay, so explain what this is for people who maybe are new to Palm Beach County or didn't participate before.
Sure. We've actually done this. This is our fifth time. We do it every 2 years, and we try to involve every adult in the county in reading the same book at the same time. And we've done it so successfully in other years that former Governor Bush sent out a letter to every mayor in the state and said, do what Palm Beach County's doing, do a community-wide reading campaign.
Okay, so you just had the big meeting. Now the books, first of all, how many books were in this big pile to begin with? Hundreds?
Hundreds. We spend the 2 years getting hundreds of suggestions from people all over the county, and we try to get it down to five books that we think will appeal to a diverse audience.
All right, so five books made the cut.
That's right.
And the good news is we get to pick the book.
That's it. We have found, first of all, let me say, the reason we do this whole campaign is, unfortunately, about 50% of the population, the adult population who can read, chooses every year not to read one single book.
All right, let's stop right there. 50% of adults did not read a book last year?
That's right. And when we first started this campaign in 2002, I won't say which community leader, but a very key community leader said, you know, this is a good campaign because I actually haven't read a book since college. And I think, unfortunately, there are a lot of adults that are in that category.
Knowing that, and here you are, the executive director of the Palm Beach Literacy Coalition, how does that make you feel?
Well, of course, I would say 90% of our work is geared towards the population, the adults, children, and families who can't read, who don't have literacy skills. But we do this one campaign to say to the folks who can, boy, it's a great thing that you know how to read, so use those skills and really read together, discuss together, and get our community much more involved in civic engagement.
Okay, if I had a drum roll, I would do it. So give us the five books that made the cut.
All right. The five books that were just announced. First of all, by Jamie Ford, The Hotel on the Corner of Bitter and Sweet. I've read all of these books, and they're all personal favorites. But this one is a very, very tender, wonderful book.
What is that about, may I ask?
It's basically, it takes place during World War II, during the Japanese internment. It's heartbreaking as you experience that with the family that's involved. But it also has a lot of timeless themes where you see the expectations that a father has for their child and how the child has to deal with that. So,
okay, that's number one, Hotel on the Corner of Bitter and Sweet.
Secondly, by Tim O'Brien, is The Things They Carried. And this is a book from the Vietnam era, beautifully written, When I read the first chapter, I just stayed up and said to my husband, I've got to read some of this aloud to you. It's just so beautifully written. So I think everybody can certainly appreciate it, especially we who know so many people who've been involved in conflict. We want them to be able to, we want to read it to be able to understand what they've gone through.
I read this book quite a while ago. I mean, many, many years ago. It's a great book. It certainly could stand a reread.
Absolutely. Very relevant for our time. And then thirdly, Ann Patchett, who's written a number of wonderful books, but the one we have chosen is Run. And I don't know, have you read that one?
I've read the book. I actually interviewed Ann Patchett, I believe, last year. Very timely book, very interesting book about a political family in the Northeast.
Absolutely. And again, it, like all of these books, has so many different themes that will resonate with different segments of the community.
A good read.
Very good book.
And
the next is certainly a favorite of many, many people, written by Marianne Schaefer and Annie Barrows, The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society.
Okay, I read the book. It was absolutely nothing like what I thought it was going to be, and I loved every word in that book.
You know, it's written in a little different style because it's written in letters, and it took me about the first five or six letters until I really got into it, and then I couldn't put it down. I just stayed up and read it in basically one night. It's a very quick read, but it's very touching, and again, it deals with a lot of different themes that I think different parts of the community will really enjoy discussing.
Absolutely. And number five.
And the number five is a wonderful book, The Book Thief. And it is a book that actually is on bookshelves often as a youth book or as a teen book, but absolutely wonderful for adults and youth to read together. It has so many themes in it. Of course, it's very good for a literacy coalition to be promoting because it certainly talks about the value of books, especially in a society that was banning them.
This is interesting. Four out of the five have element of war and strife going through them, I see.
That's
Run
true.
Has a different kind of war. But
that's right. Right.
So what do we do now?
Basically, we have all over the county, literally in all of the libraries, most bookstores, every Starbucks store and Park Avenue Barbecue and Grill restaurants, in all of those locations, there are ballot boxes, very colorful ballot boxes and ballots, where the public can go in and cast their vote for the book they think would be the best book. Now, if you aren't going to any of those locations and want to just turn on your computer, you can go to HTTP, readtogether.palmbeachpost.com and vote online.
Okay.
So we try to make it easy so that everybody can cast their vote.
And this is the time. Now we are voting.
This is the voting period. As a matter of fact, the voting will end February 5th. So it's very important that your listeners get out there and vote and make their voice heard so that the book can be selected. And we will announce the selection on March 1st at a press conference.
After March 1st, typically there are all of these book-related events that go on in the community, which I assume I will be hearing more about from you.
Absolutely. We're in the formulating the plans. We anticipate having a finale at the Harriet Theater as we have in other years. And a lot will depend on which book is chosen, whether or not we're able to get the author to come. But that certainly is the plan.
The most fun part for me, and I think I speak for a lot of people, are the discussion groups. And in the years past, it seems like every single book has led to incredible discussions.
It really has. I know the year we were reading To Kill a Mockingbird, we had such a poignant email from a mother who said, I believe she lived in Wellington, and she said she was reading the book and her daughter was reading the book, and at the same time, an incident of real discrimination happened in their community. And so because they've been reading it together, they said, we've got to do something about this. So it certainly gives you the opportunity to discuss on light levels, deep levels, but to get together with your coworkers, your neighbors, people in all levels of your life to read and discuss the book.
We will also be doing our own book discussion here on this show.
Wonderful.
As well, too.
That is great news.
No matter what book it is, but I know which one I'm going to vote for anyway.
Okay.
Speaking of To Kill a Mockingbird, I remember that year, wasn't it the actress that played Scout in
That's
the
right.
movie came to the
That's right.
That was fun.
Every year the finale has had a different twist, depending on who the author is, and we're just looking forward to seeing who the public is going to choose here, so we'll know how to gear the finale.
Okay, folks, vote.
Absolutely.
Now, you can't leave because you have to tell me about the Love of Literacy Luncheon.
Absolutely, because that is actually the kickoff for the campaign. It's at March 26th at the Kravis Center, and tickets are already available. Folks can go online and buy tickets, and or we also, of course, have table sponsorships. But the focus of the event will be to kick off Read Together, to celebrate reading and literacy, and we have a wonderful speaker, a character actor, Tony Plana, who some people may know as the widowed father in Ugly Betty.
Of course.
But he's also very well known for his many, many roles in TV shows like Hill Street Blues, West Wing. I believe he was the Secretary of State on West Wing, also on CSI, and then in countless feature films.
This is always a big hit of the season, your Love of Literacy Luncheon. Time is of the essence. I suggest you go ahead and make your arrangements now.
Absolutely. I want to say also the luncheon speaker, in addition to all these other things, he's a very strong literacy advocate. He's Cuban-American. He's done a great deal with minority youth to involve them in theater, drama, and therefore to increase their literacy skills.
Speaking of literacy skills, this is what you do at the Literacy Coalition. There are thousands of people here in Palm Beach County who cannot read or whose skills are so poor that they are suffering and are not employable. What you do is assist them in learning to read so that they can better themselves. Are you now looking for volunteers to assist you?
We are always looking for volunteers to tutor adults, and we have a training coming up at the end of the month. So if anyone listening is interested in being an adult tutor, actually they can go on our website, which is www.literacypbc.org, and they can sign up today for that training and to become an adult literacy tutor.
We've talked before. I think the tutor probably gets as much or more out of the experience than the person they're tutoring.
That is so true. And I just want to say on a personal note, everything I've said for all these years has really come home because we've had a foster child in our expanded family for the last couple of months. She's in first grade and is failing first grade miserably because she didn't have parents who read to her in her preschool years. So it's everything we do to try to reach the adults who need the help, to get them involved in literacy classes so that they can be good parents, have books in the home, and read to their children so we can have children succeed in school. So it really takes all of us working together to make this happen.
It comes full circle. Darlene, speaking of parents reading to their children, and there are plenty of very well-educated parents in this audience who are very overworked, and you know the day is short and the kids are from one thing to another, but carving out those few moments at the end of the day to read to your child,
it's
priceless.
It's crucial. And I think if parents, even if it's only 5 minutes, we hope it'll be 15 or 20 every single day, but if that could be the child's most favored moments that they look forward to all day and that they don't want to miss with their parents, those times of reading books, even if they're small children, just looking at picture books together, but to make books part of the home.
I am sure growing up you cherished books. I'm sure your family, you know, built that sense of love of reading in your home. And I think about adults, because you just mentioned it a little while ago, that 50% didn't read a book last year. If children see a parent reading, certainly they will gravitate to a book.
That is so true. And I just think as we're all dealing with our New Year's resolutions, if we could put on that list, certainly we want to watch television, especially WXEL. But
and especially, let's see, actor Tony Plana.
That's right, for sure.
Okay, Ugly Betty.
But if we would, as adults, use good judgment and say, I am going to be sure that we do turn the TV off for some moments every night, that we as a family can have this reading time. It's really very important to model that for our children.
All right. In the meantime, go and cast your vote for the book that we're all going to be reading at the same time in Palm Beach County. Five choices. You can go to the website. And where else can we go?
You can go to any library, most bookstores, Park Avenue Barbecue and Grill restaurants, and any Starbucks store, and cast your vote.
You heard her. Darlene Kostrup is the executive director of the Palm Beach Literacy Coalition. Darlene, thank you.
My pleasure.
This year marks the 150th anniversary of the Jupiter Inlet Lighthouse. 150 years. Just think about what that lighthouse has seen that it could tell us. In this segment, we are exploring that history along with the history of Tyndall House, one of the oldest existing homes in Palm Beach County. And my guest is Jim Snyder. He's the author of five books on local Florida history. He is the board chairman of the Loxahatchee River Historical Society, and the society also operates the Jupiter Inlet Lighthouse and Museum. Jim, thank you for coming in.
My pleasure.
The Historical Society, which operates this lighthouse, the lighthouse was built in 1860. So what does it take to maintain a 150-year-old lighthouse?
Well, increasingly, it takes more capital than a historical society has. And it's fortunate that in 2008, May, Congress enacted a law that put the entire lighthouse property under the ownership and protection of the Interior Department through the Bureau of Land Management. And that's been a big help. And essentially, they own the grounds. It means that developers can't put up condos on it or anything like that. And they are able to take care of some of the capital infrastructure projects at the lighthouse. Like the mound that surrounds the lighthouse has slipped a little bit. Well, they put $500,000 into bringing some 50 truckloads of dirt and putting it up there. They are shoring up the eroded shoreline around the lighthouse. And
I'm sure all those hurricanes we had didn't do it any favors.
Well, it never does, no. But that's been very good. And the Historical Society is in charge of the operations. We do the tours. We run the museum. We do educational projects. And we run the Tyndall House that you mentioned.
Tell me the history of the lighthouse.
Well, you have to remember, first of all, I have to set the stage here. Back in that time, 1859, when it began, there were only 600 people in the whole 250-mile stretch from Titusville to what is now Miami. There wasn't even a Miami then. And this was wild and woolly land, much akin to going to the Amazon or darkest Africa. And people only went down here in scientific expeditions and things of that nature. So building a lighthouse at Jupiter was regarded as the most difficult logistic thing that the lighthouse service ever attempted. Sort of like going to the moon, you might say.
You're building this lighthouse in an area where there aren't many people. I mean, it's pretty wild.
That's right. And the reason for that is that there were reefs around Jupiter. There were no roads in anywhere south of Jacksonville, no railroads. So everything moved by sea. And the reefs around Jupiter were very treacherous, and at any given time in the 1800s, you could find five or six wrecked crews standing out on the beach between Jupiter and Key Biscayne. Either they would perish or they might get lucky and somebody would spot them and pick them up. So putting a lighthouse here was an important priority.
And the people that constructed it, where did they come from?
Well, this was done by the U.S. Lighthouse Service, which had only been formed in 1852. Going back to colonial days, lighthouses were just a jumble of different sizes and shapes and different kinds of owners. Could be a local government. It could be just Joe Blow who wanted to build a lighthouse to protect his shipping or merchant. And so they standardized the lighthouses pretty much. And Congress decided that it wanted to build six of them along the coast of Florida. The ideal was to have no ship captain without sight of a light all the way down the coast of Florida. And Florida, by the way, was a very difficult thing. to sail by, because the blue waters in the daytime would turn to gray at night, and there were no landmarks. There was no mountains you could see, no lights glowing, and everything just dissolved into gray. So if a captain wasn't real careful, he could go right into the shore and into the reefs and or just up on the sand and wreck his boat. So this was an interesting project, and if I might just add, it also was a project that almost never was. And the reason for that is that back in 1859 in Washington, political parties, the North and the South, were pretty much beginning to choose up sides for what would become a civil war officially in April 1861. But by that, when a lighthouse project came up before the Lighthouse Board, which was a separate organization than the Lighthouse Service, it was viewed by its members, who were pretty much political appointees, as would it help the South or would it help the North? And there were powerful interests from the South on that board, and they didn't want to see a lighthouse built in Jupiter because it would protect the ships that were going down to the Navy base in Key West. So they didn't want that at all, but they were trumped by a man who was also on the board, who was a great-great-grandson of Benjamin Franklin, and he had more political connections than the Southerners did, and Jupiter finally got voted on.
All part of the history that we can discover for ourselves when we visit. Is it open to the public daily?
Oh, it sure is, except for Mondays.
Except for Mondays. Mm-hmm. What makes it so significant, historically speaking?
Well, for the reasons that I just said, it's certainly the oldest building in South Florida. Key Biscayne Lighthouse, they can claim to be, but they were closed down for 50 years after an Indian attack after they were built in 1826. So this one has been the longest in continuous operation.
Speaking of old, I want to get to the Tyndall House, which fascinates me. One of the oldest homes in Palm Beach County, and now it has been moved, and it has been reopened.
Yes, it has. It's been moved a few times. The Tyndall House is today a representation, pretty darn authentic, of a typical cracker house in the years from 1890 to about 1910. It is not the identical Tyndall House, and the reason for that is, first of all, it had to be built to Miami hurricane standards, which changed the outside appearance a little bit. Secondly, the original George Tyndall family that occupied that house were poor as church mice. And they didn't have some of the nice furniture that's now in the lighthouse.
Why did they come to Jupiter in the 1890s?
Well, they were just hardscrabble farmers who saw an opportunity to have their own homestead. Unfortunately, they had just gotten their homestead established when a neighbor came along and said, "You're sitting on my land." So they had to move the house 100 yards somewhere else up the river. This, by the way, the Tyndall House originally was about 2 miles up the Loxahatchee River from where it is today by the lighthouse. And the Tyndall family, they were just hard luck gang, you might say. Their cattle died because the cattle ate sawgrass. They did their best to raise crops, but was never enough. They had to go begging at the railroad station. The few trains that came through Jupiter at that time, and they had so little furniture that they ate most of their meals out in the front yard on tree stumps, but then they complained that when they would do that, the crows and other birds would come and swoop down on them and try to eat the crumbs that they were producing.
What is this, pitiful?
I know. Well, on top of that, Mrs. Tyndall got seriously ill. She couldn't walk. Nobody knew what was the reason. And her daughters and son had to, by this time, Mr. Tyndall, who was mysteriously absent from time to time, nobody knows exactly where, but they had to take her down to the train station and put her on a train and move up with her parents in Jackson, or I think it was Baltimore, for a while. But the ironic thing is, 2 or 3 years later, when she was back to health, they came back to Jupiter. So there must have been some wonderful pull about living in Jupiter.
Something attracted them to Jupiter. Yeah. I can't even imagine what Jupiter was like in 1892, but it couldn't have been too great.
No, there wasn't much to Jupiter. If it had 150 people in it, that would be lucky.
So the house now is located where?
It is right on, right inside the fence that where tours begin to go up the lighthouse. We call it the History Corridor because it's sort of a loop that leads up to the lighthouse. Let's just say the lighthouse is at 12 o'clock and this begins at 6 o'clock. The Tyndall House is located at about 8 o'clock on the loop. And it's a work in progress and will always be. We're right now building a slat house where they would raise ferns. And these were ferns to put in bouquets for flowers, and they would ship these ferns up north. We're going to have an outhouse, by golly. We have a separate kitchen building, and the members of the Loxahatchee Guild are working very hard to select the proper furniture. It is open, but it'll be changing.
They have to be very proud. I know the Guild has been working overtime
to get
this house complete and open to the public. Mm-hmm. Have you always had this passion for history?
Well, I think so, just as a not necessarily Jupiter history, because I only arrived here in 1992. And it was after I used to publish magazines in Washington, and I sold that company in 1997 and started looking around to what am I going to do when I grow up. And I've always liked to write more than anything, and that and history kind of merged.
I know you were the author of 5 books on local history, one about Trapper Nelson, which is absolutely a fascinating character. You must have been so intrigued by the stories that you heard about him when you moved here.
I was intrigued by that. I am also a kayaker, and I live about a mile and a half down the river from Trapper's. And when my wife and I would go there in our kayaks and get out at the ranger's station that was right there, they only had a single page about Trapper Nelson. I thought that was rather weird because it's the centerpiece of Jonathan Dickinson State Park, and there was hardly anything about it. Well, that just led to my interviewing family members and things of that nature, and out came a book.
And the book we're talking about is Life and Death on the Loxahatchee,
yes,
the story of Trapper Nelson. To find out more about the Tyndall House, to find out more about the lighthouse, I did go to your website. And I have to say, it is one of the best.
Yes, it is. The gentleman who did that is very imaginative. There's a lot of little gadgets and levers for people.
It is very interactive. It is full of information. It is a really good website. It is lrhs.org.
Yes.
lrhs.org.
Or jupiterinletlighthouse.org. There's two ways to get at it.
So this is a big weekend for you.
Yes, indeed. It is. We will have people from Washington coming down. This is very important to them. This is, as part of that congressional act that I mentioned to you, we were declared an outstanding natural area, which is one step below a national park. But for the Bureau of Land Management, which manages millions of acres west of the Mississippi, it has hardly any properties east of the Mississippi. So this is its first outstanding natural area east of the Mississippi. And the people there in Washington are clucking over this newborn chick very carefully. And so all of the folks in leadership positions in Washington are coming down, and I'm going to give a little speech about why the 150th is important. And Bruce Dawson, the chief organizer for the Bureau of Land Management, is going to talk about the transition, the 3-year management plan that they are going to do, which starts now. And then thirdly, a gentleman who heads the Bureau of Land Management is going to talk about their plans for outstanding natural areas in general for the next 150 years, if you will. So it's a big moment for us. And this will be surrounded, by the way. It starts at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And we will have all sorts of fun and games for families. It'll be free, by the way. There will be barbershop quartets, and there will be other singing groups. And I think we're even having a cake decorating contest, and it's lighthouse cakes. So there'll be a whole lot of restaurants and hotels making lighthouse cakes.
It sounds terrific. Jim Snyder, you've been a wonderful guest. Jim is chairman of the Loxahatchee River Historical Society Board. Kudos on all the work that the society has done, that the Loxahatchee Guild has done. Terrific restoration, and we're looking forward to seeing it.
Thank you.
Alexia Davis and Roger Ward are here from the Norton Museum of Art. And yes, we're going to talk about art, but we are also going to let you in on what happens in the evening, once a month, they have these very clever, innovative events, and these are on Thursdays, and it's called Art After Dark. And Lexi, I'm going to let you explain. What is it?
Okay, well, Art After Dark is this wonderful program that we launched back in June to great success. And it's an opportunity for folks to come by the museum that may not be able to get there otherwise. You know, we understand that it's difficult during the week. Obviously, we're 10 to 5 if you work. So this gives you an opportunity to swing by on your way home from work. If you can't fit us into your busy schedule on the weekend, it's the second Thursday of every month. The museum is open from 5 to 9 p.m. And it's just really a cool opportunity to view the museum, the exhibitions that we have on. And we always have live music. There's usually a film screening, hands-on art activities. There's something different every time, but you'll typically have a lot of the sort of same, you know, fresh, new music, films, and activities happening.
But each month is different. So if I went last month, or if I went in June or July, this month is going to be different.
Exactly, exactly.
Who is it geared toward, other than people that work, obviously, that couldn't come in the daytime? Who shows up?
Everybody. Everybody shows up. That's what's so great about it. We really have everything from, you know, young families with little kids running around and doing the hands-on art activities. We have, you know, college kids, folks in their 20s to 30s, older couples. Really, it's just a little bit of everyone, which is what makes it such a remarkable event.
You have music at these events. It's nobody going, shh, you know, don't be loud in the museum.
No, there is no shushing in the museum during this. And that's what's really nice about it, too, is it's really just a hub of activity during this. And every month, the music is different. So depending on what you're into, you know, you have an opportunity every month to come check it out and see what you like. For example, the January 14th event, we have Be Liminal, which is a surf rock reggae band. We've had great jazz musicians, and it's always going to be something different and fresh and kind of cool.
Sometimes it's an opportunity for dinner and a movie.
There you go.
Because
not only is
Cafe 1451 open throughout, serving from the evening and dinner menu for that entire period, but there's also a movie in the theater. So it can be a very convenient and easy place to just come and do those two things. Don't have to go anywhere else in the museum. Don't have to come and look at anything else or hear the music or whatever. And it's been used a lot for that, we've been told.
Well, I want to say that on January 14th, we, WXEL, are partnering with you for one of your Art After Dark, because people that have a member card are going to get a little break on the event, which is very cool. And this would be probably one of the last times to view the William Kentridge Five Themes exhibition.
It is. That exhibition will be closing January 17th, so it'll be a great opportunity to view the William Kentridge Five Themes exhibition, which was recently nominated number 2 in Time Magazine's top 10 exhibitions of 2009. So that's quite an accolade. And
I would say that's quite an accolade.
And like Roger said, it really is an opportunity. You can come see the band. There's actually not a film screening for the one on January 14th, but the theme is Go Global. So we're going for an international feel. We'll have tours of the Chinese collection. They always have special offerings at Cafe 1451. You know, kid-friendly menu options as well. An Artini.
I love
that.
Recommend. An Artini. Mm-hmm. Yes, and the WXEO members are going to get half-off admission.
Yes,
that's
so
what
it will
I was
only
told.
Be $6.
That is fabulous. Now, tell me about William Kentridge. Roger, even Time Magazine called him one of the, I think, top 100 most influential people of 2009.
Yes, he's been active on the international art scene for quite some time, probably for 20 years or so. But before he was an artist, he was an actor. So this is really his second career, in a sense. He became better known to people in South Florida 5 years ago. Could it be 6? But there was an exhibition of his work at the space that I always think of as the Cisneros space in Coral Gables, the gallery that was operated by the Cisneros family until quite recently. That was his first major exhibition in this part of the world. It was it was staged at the time of Art Basel in Miami Beach, of course. And so a lot of people who had come to this neighborhood to go to the art fair that year first came into contact with Kentridge via that show, as did I and as did most people at the Norton. You're quite right. He was recently named by Time Magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in the world and the only artist on that list. Then when they came to the end of the year, as you know, they do their top 10 of this, that, and everything, 10 most embarrassing sports stars, 10 most wonderful, whatever it might be. And this exhibition, as Lexi said, was number 2 on their list of the 10 best, most important exhibitions anywhere in the world. It was named the number 1 exhibition by the International Art Critics Organization. And we'll probably, when it goes from us to the Museum of Modern Art in New York, where it will open at the end of February. I think it'll just go from strength to strength. It'll probably have even more sort of attention and press coverage and so forth once it's there in New York City.
You know, Roger, I was going to say you will be sorry to see it leave, but when we talk a little later in interviews that are going to follow, there's so much fabulous stuff that's going to be happening at the Norton this year. Yes, we're sorry William Kentridge will be going. This is your last chance. But wow, this season is spectacular. And we will talk more about that. In February, Lexi, you're going to do another Art After Dark.
Yes, and again on the second Thursday. So this time it will fall on February 11th. And the theme for this one is I Heart Art.
I Heart Art. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it's obviously a little Valentine's Day inspiration going on there. And we will have Rachel Goodrich performing, who is out of Miami. And she's known for what she has coined as her shakeabilly music, which is kind of funky. And she's a real up-and-comer. And I'm sure she'll provide a good time for everyone. And at the same time, we'll have the Palm Beach Opera Young Singers there. Two of their singers will be there performing some pieces from Don Giovanni.
Is this one of these events where you show up, you don't quite know what it's going to be, and then you continue to see the same people month after month?
Well, we do see some of the same people returning because we're hoping it's the sort of thing that really is just on your calendar every month. You fit us in that Thursday evening. But we always see new faces too, which is really nice. And we've had great attendance. And this upcoming February 11th event will also offer tours of the Tapestries from Vienna exhibition.
I know Roger and I are going to be talking about that, but we'll give you a little sneak preview into this. I don't think this exhibition has ever been out of Austria before. Am I correct?
That is correct.
So this is something quite spectacular to see these gigantic tapestries. You know, the Norton, you've always done such a great job on offering to all ages and all sizes. I think the Art After Dark is especially an upbeat, friendly atmosphere. Do we need to call in advance? Do we need to have a ticket? How does this work?
You absolutely do not have to call in advance. You can just show up. It goes on from 5 to 9. You don't have to be there right at 5. Usually the music starts around 6:30. There's always something going on, and as soon as you get there, you can just pick up a schedule when you arrive. If you want to see the schedule ahead of time to plan, if you want to make sure you catch the band or whatever it is for that particular evening, you can just go on norton.org. And Art After Dark is on our homepage, and you can just click and see the schedules there, and you do not have to pay in advance.
Speaking of schedules, before you leave, and I know we are going to explore in detail the highlights of the season, but Wet Air Whistles, give me a sneak preview of what we're going to see this season. You did mention the tapestries.
Well, we do. We have the Habsburg tapestries from Vienna coming up. We will also have a Richard Avedon fashion photography exhibition that opens early February. That'll be a very comprehensive and impressive fashion photography show.
So these will run almost at the same time, Roger. Is that correct? The
We often have 3 or even 4 exhibitions running simultaneously. Mm-hmm. Not exactly on precisely the same schedule, they overlap. So they run consecutively and simultaneously both, but we frequently have 3, sometimes even 4 shows of different sizes and shapes and different kinds of subjects and so forth, the intention being really to provide as rich a menu as possible for everyone who happens to be here, really no matter what time of year, whether it's the height of season like now or as we're heading into, or even through the summer. Always trying to have something there that is available and accessible for the audience and anybody who is around and looking for something interesting and different to do. It's 145,000 square feet of air conditioning, as we like to say in the summertime. It's a great place to come no matter what the weather or time of year.
Wonderful destination, and certainly you are keeping the people that do the installations very busy with all of these goings on, especially those tapestries. That must have been difficult to install. What else will we see after the Avedon?
After the Avedon exhibition opens, well, February is a very busy month. So February 13th, we actually have three exhibitions opening, speaking of the installation folks being busy at the museum. We have Reclaimed, which are paintings from the collection of Jacques Hoodsticker. We have the RFK Funeral Train Rediscovered, which are the photographs by Paul Fusco. And then we also have Here Comes the Sun, Warhol, and Art After 1960 at the Norton, which is an installation of contemporary art drawn from the museum's collection.
This is fantastic. Roger, the season looks remarkable to me.
We think it's very strong, and we're pleased with the diversity. There are exhibitions that touch on all kinds of different subjects, and we think probably will appeal to people who are interested in certain media. Obviously, photography is getting has a long hand with this great Avedon show organized by the International Center for Photography in New York City, the largest exhibition of works by Avedon since a retrospective that was at the Metropolitan 12 or 15 years ago now. But this exhibition, I think it has over 130 photographs. It concentrates specifically on his career as a great fashion photographer, starting right after World War II in the late 40s and all the way up until the time of his death. There are also exhibitions in the summertime that are different in terms of the fare that would be offered, let's say, you know, at this time of year. We always try and do something that is family-oriented and is going to be especially popular with children who come to us both in the form of summer campers as well as just with their own friends and family during the summer months. So this year we have the wonderful exhibition of Dinotopia, organized by the Norman Rockwell Museum. And Dinotopia is an imaginary, invented continent inhabited quite impossibly by dinosaurs, mammals, and human beings all at the same time. And it had become the invention of the artist James Gurney. He actually invented it for his own children when they were toddlers. It became then a television mini-series, as it were, and is now it's in the industry, sort of like the Harry Potter films and all of the memorabilia and paraphernalia and ancillary material that go along with something with an literary event like Harry Potter. With Dinotopia, the exhibition consists of the great, magnificent watercolors that he did inventing the books and so forth and so on. But we will have all kinds of other things going on around the exhibition, hands-on to do things, like even including a giant, what's called a dig box, where children can find their own dinosaur bones 2 feet down and that kind of thing.
And you know children and probably their parents will not want to leave. Thank you very much. We'll be talking more with Roger in an upcoming show. I want to thank you very much. Go to norton.org to find out all the particulars of the exhibitions and the times, and especially the Art After Dark that's coming up every Thursday, the second Thursday of every month. Lexi Davis, Roger Ward, thank you so much for being here today. I want to thank all of the guests on today's Florida Forum. Elisa New, her new book is Jacob's Cane, Darlene Kostrub from the Palm Beach Literacy Coalition, and Jim Snyder from the Loxahatchee River Historical Society. To reach us, send us an email, floridaforum@wxel.org. The producer for Florida Forum is Denise Sears. Our engineer is Steve Cody. I'm Ann Bocock. Thank you for listening.